Happy New Year and happy 2016 to all of our listeners. I hope January's been treating you all well. We were fortunate to round out last month with a great review and probably an even better peer review of the 2015 American Heart Association guidelines on adult cardiac arrest and acute coronary syndrome. Now, for a new year, we're going in a completely different direction. That's right, it's the Pediatric American Heart Association guidelines in all of its glory. It's all American Heart all the time here on AZMcast. Okay, in seriousness, this will be the last time we cover these guidelines, because next month we have, that's going to be the resident in-service exam review. Hold on, let me get my calendar. Sometime in 2018, we'll stop going over various guidelines and we'll get back to whatever it is that we were doing before this. Anyway, this month we will be talking with one of the authors of the American Heart Association guidelines, Dr. Mark Berg, who's a pediatric intensivist, and we're going to ask him about the updates for pediatric guidelines. While we were interviewing, we also tried to pry into the interworkings of the American Heart Association to get a little behind the scenes on how the sausage is made, so to speak. Great insight from Mark, and we're very happy to have him on the show. Our peer review this month is from our own Art Sanders, who asked to provide a supplementary historical and philosophical opinion to Dr. Rosen's review from November. He gave some incredible insight as well, and I think you're going to like it. In fact, I'm willing to bet you'll like this whole program or your money back. One last thing, we're back to the bell ding for evidence-based support of our crazy claims, but I like the turkey so much, I'm keeping it over the foghorn. Now, on with the free show. So continuing on with more American Heart, we have Dr. Mark Berg, a pediatric intensivist and one of the authors for the last couple guidelines, who is joining us. And he's given us a little insight not only into some of the updates for the new PALS guidelines, but any insight he wants to share with us about kind of how they come to these conclusions and how difficult it must be to assimilate all this into nice, easy to understand and easy to implement guidelines. So welcome, Mark.
Thank you, Aaron. Glad to be in the studio.
So probably the easiest thing to start with for both of those is ABC versus CAB. I think when the first round of the guidelines came out, I asked you, we know most pediatric arrests are respiratory, and yet we're changing that to cardiac airway breathing instead of airway breathing circulation. And at the time, it seemed like we just needed to streamline the guidelines so that people would listen and do chest compressions. But what's kind of changed in the thought now of CAB versus ABC?
Well, you know, this all started in 2010 guidelines, and you're absolutely right. The motivation for the changes were to really try to standardize as much as possible across adult and pediatric resuscitation, the approach. And honestly, a lot of that is based in some of the work by a guy named Bob Swore. And he published a very interesting paper. There was plenty of literature on the subject of why people don't do bystander CPR, and including a paper that was done by the late Catherine Locke. She used to be here. She was the late wife of Bob Berg, who was my mentor and is now at CHOP. Anyway, Kathy Locke published a paper way back when that you may look at, looking at reasons why people don't do bystander CPR. And there were the usual thoughts, well, you know, people are worried about getting some crazy disease by mouth-to-mouth, and they're worried about this and that. And Bob Swore's paper is fascinating because he actually talked to people that did bystander CPR and found out what were the barriers to either performing or not performing it. And interestingly enough, found that people weren't afraid of getting diseases and stuff. And people actually were more afraid of doing it wrong. And so that really drove home the point that every complexity you add to CPR is actually a huge barrier to the performance of CPR, especially as it pertains to lay public bystander CPR. So all this stuff of, you know, tilt the head, do this with the chin, and pinch the nose, and lick, listen, and feel, and I mean, all of that was, you know, just a hindrance to most people. So it was proposed for 2010. Hey, let's try to standardize around CAB, and it made a lot of sense for adult resuscitation with the whole way the science has gone with even compression only CPR. What happened was there was some great debate within pediatrics for just the reason that you note. We've recognized increasingly that there is a significant component of pediatric cardiac arrest that is, for lack of a better term, adult-type cardiac arrest. It is primarily cardiac. That's the kid who falls on the soccer field, right? The sudden VF arrest. But still, that may only be 30%. So 70%, or somewhere in that range, are kids that enter their arrest event from an initial asphyxial problem. And wow, why wouldn't you provide initial airway breathing to those kids? And so that was really a big debate within the I was in the room for those discussions. And suffice to say, some of the godfathers of pediatric CPR were very much, there was a lot of back and forth, just put it that way. In the end, what won out was the goal of simplicity. And if you read 2010 guidelines carefully, and in the current PALS edition, it specifically states that, I know you're nervous about not starting with breaths, but by the fact that you start with compressions, you're only delaying CPR about 18, or you're only delaying your breaths about 18 seconds, right, if you do 15 compressions. And so that made people feel better to say, well, okay, it's only an 18-second delay to breaths. Let me add one caveat. The guidelines are always just the guidelines. So, they're meant to be, ideally they're adhered to because they're based in science, and we may have a chance to talk about how the guidelines come to be. But if you're in a certain setting, and you're a clinician, you're in an emergency department, you're in the ICU, you are free to apply your specific knowledge to the situation. So let's say you have a kid who is known to have recurrent VFVT, and you're in the ICU, and he suddenly arrests. Well, that patient needs compression. Well, needs defibrillation as soon as possible, right? And compressions. Let's say you're working in the ED and there's some kid who has a severe tracheitis and is becoming obtunded with hypercarbia and is coughing up, obstructing mucus plugs and then has an arrest. That kid probably needs an airway procedure, right? He probably needs some breaths. So I just toss that in there. For your listeners.
Yeah, it's interesting because, most of us say, well, we're chefs, we've been trained and we don't need to follow recipe the same way. Right. But my mom is actually one of the American Heart instructors up in Phoenix. And there are plenty of people she works with that says the guidelines are exacting and you follow them to the letter or else people will die. And that's right. How they run their class. And so it's always kind of a mixed message, but there's definitely, it's something to work off of. It's better than having nothing, right. And not everybody has done, 4 years of medical school, 3 to 4 years of residency, fellowships, however many things you're going to add on to that, and then a wealth of experience of actually running these later.
Yeah.
So I definitely followed the guidelines to the letter years ago. I'm a little more pliable with it now.
Yeah,
probably
I guess
will be more as I get older.
I guess the general concept also with anything. You can't really break the rules until you know the rules, right? So let's all know the rules. Let's know the guidelines very well. And they should really apply in the huge majority of cases. But I just, toss that in there. So you can give yourself some flexibility. So how does CAB go with 2015? Well, the literature between 2010 and 2015 is primarily from mannequin studies, and it shows that what you would expect with a CAB approach, chest compression starts sooner. Oh, imagine that. And in the space of a minute, there are proportionally more chest compressions. So nothing too surprising there. At my last review, which was to get the guidelines ready to publish, there was no human study yet that showed either a benefit or a harm to using a CAB approach in children. So if we loved it in 2010, I guess we can still love it in 2015.
That's good.
Yeah. So
those were kind of the main changes to BLS, pediatric BLS,
right.
That we're seeing. So most of the other changes kind of refer a little bit more to the advanced life support. So the biggest one that's come out is even before you actually get to the resuscitation or the cardiac arrest is the septic shock kids. The recommendation to use cautious IV fluids in children with septic shock. This goes against everything as an emergency doctor I believe in. Everyone needs fluids as much as possible. combustible right. until they puff out. Right. But based on the FEAST trial that was done, we're now not only changing the practice in low resource places, but are you guys thinking we need to take another look at fluid boluses in kids in developed countries or places with more resources?
Yeah, so another hugely controversial point of discussion for those of us involved in guidelines preparation. It's actually probably a good chance to do a quick little tour through how guidelines come to be. You know, there's this process that's called ILCOR, the International Liaison Committee on Resuscitation. About 300 physician scientists examine somewhere around 400 questions in resuscitation in a very rigorous manner. I volunteered to do one. It's kind of like writing the term paper from hell. I mean, you get I think I had a few thousand articles to kind of initially get through after a search of everything ever published, and then it comes down in my case probably 50 articles that I had to review very carefully, et cetera. And it's a process that goes on over about a year and a half. It's international, and the product of that is the COSTAR document, which is the consensus on treatment, consensus on science, treatment, and recommendations. COSTAR. That's also published. You can see those at ILCOR.org. I will tell you if you want to be the instant expert in getting ready for a presentation, or if you're looking for a research area, you go find, I mean, the work that someone like myself and 400 other doctor or scientists have already done on a specific topic, you will be ready to start, you know, so you will know 99% of what there is to know about that topic. But anyway, the point is, from those COSTAR recommendations, then each individual council, in the case of North America, it is the American Heart Association, says, well, what are the guidelines? How are we going to turn this world consensus on science into a guideline for our citizens? And as you might imagine, Australia would be different than America. Maybe they have different EMS models, for example. Physician EMS teams may change things. Their hospital models are different. Their geography is different. Their disease burden is different. So then we come to this trial. It's the FEAST trial, and it showed that, it's just even so hard to dissect it. There are so many caveats with applying the FEAST trial to where we live and work, which is in first world North America. But the FEAST trial showed that those children that had more aggressive fluid resuscitation did more poorly. Now, these were children with malaria primarily, and of course one of the criticisms is, hey, you know, they don't actually need fluid, they need blood. And the more important caveat is the resource limitations they were operating with were so severe that these were settings where there was no mechanical ventilation available. So if someone had a degree of pulmonary edema with fluid resuscitation, getting intubated and having some PEEP was not an option. I've always said that's why God made PEEP, right? Is when you adequately resuscitated someone with fluid and then they needed some help, then we had PEEP, right? And you could oxygenate them through their resolution of their pulmonary edema. So if the first thing you learn in evidence-based medicine is to look at a paper and say, does this apply to my patient? There's a big disconnect right there, because you're not working in third world setting without ventilators, and you're not taking care of patients with malarial shock. However, the committee involved in guidelines said there is other evidence that shows in critical care that fluid balance matters, and we're starting to kind of realize that more in the last few years, that looking at people's cumulative fluid burden in the first 48 or 72 hours, I don't remember the literature that well, but those patients, as you might expect, that had more fluid spent longer time on ventilators, probably longer time in the ICU, etc. So in general, in critical care, we're trying to get a little bit tighter about just automatically going ahead and, oh, bolus him again kind of thing. And that, taken with what the FEAST trial may be telling us, and there may be lessons to be learned from a FEAST trial approach in first world medicine. That hasn't been done. So if someone takes that methodology from the FEAST trial, and says, well, how does it work here? Maybe we'll learn something. We felt there was enough there to get started to say, and it's very carefully worded in guidelines, please don't under-resuscitate your patients. This applied to patients with septic shock, not hemorrhagic shock, not hypovolemic shock. But I think the language we came up with is do not routinely use a fluid bolus in patients. And some folks recalled clinical settings where they've worked where it's just kind of standard. Everybody gets 20 per kilo. And I think we'd like to get away from that a little bit and say, you know, let's, just like we're understanding now that oxygen is a medicine, after resuscitation we wean it, right? It can cause harm. A fluid bolus is a medicine too, with all the usual risks and benefits. So routinely bolusing those patients we would recommend against, we would caution against. And then just as good critical care, we would advise to have a routine follow-up after any fluid administration to see. And again, that's just good medicine. I did something to a patient. Did I help them? Did I hurt them? Or did nothing happen? And so use that 20 per kilo bolus as a therapy. Follow it up. See if it worked. Don't automatically do it.
So you're saying I have to go reevaluate and reexamine my patient?
If you can imagine that.
Which also goes against everything I believe as an ER doctor. So. that's good to, you know, have that caveat. We do have lots of emergency doctors that work in low resource settings.
Right.
And if you work in a place with lots of malarial sepsis, dengue fever, a place that has a high sickle cell anemia burden, and you don't have the option of ionotropic therapy and ventilators, well, don't bolus.
Yeah.
Give blood first. Now, in developed countries, I don't know that we can really apply that yet, but it's kind of interesting to say maybe we went too far the other direction because the surviving sepsis guidelines have come out and said bolus up to and above 60 mLs per kilo in the first hour.
Yeah.
And it'll be interesting to see if there's any change with that as well.
That will be on the horizon. One thing I would say is, you know, the classic paper in this for Peds Critical Care is Joe Carcio's paper, I think in JAMA, in probably late 80s, something like that. And that was the classic 40 per kilo in kids with meningococcal sepsis. It's worth, you'll find the reference, hopefully. It's really worth taking a look at that because that's often quoted. And they were able to fillet out that patients that got 40 per kilo or more in the first hour survived, and those that got less didn't survive. So that gave us all free license to really kind of go for it in septic shock. The problem is much of the rest of the pediatric septic shock literature is based on dengue shock, which is its own unique animal. And people that have dengue fever, some do very well, some suddenly do very poorly. And so it's an evolving area for sure.
Very interesting. And it's nice to see the background into how some of this stuff comes together. What's it like to sit in one of these rooms?
So most of it is a phone conference, which is fun, but some of it is, you know, there's a twice yearly emergency cardiac care committee meeting in Dallas. And, you know, for me, it's just been a mind-blowing privilege. I mean, I've served as a volunteer now for 8 years. But just to be in the room with some of these people, you know, Leon Kaimides is a retired pediatric cardiologist from Connecticut. He wrote the first PALS book, and that goes back to, you know, early 80s, I think, 82, something like that. And so just to be able to hang out with Leon and just say, you know, he has that big lay of the land. But it's great because everyone's opinion is valued, but you kind of get in there and you fight it out, and some people will really bring unique perspectives and say, you know, specifically with respect to this resuscitation point, there were people that were very concerned that suddenly in urgent cares all over America, children that could greatly benefit from a fluid bolus would be under-resuscitated. And so, man, we fight about language like creating an arms treaty or some kind of a UN agreement or something. It's pretty interesting.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So once we have some of these kids back, we're resuscitating them. One of the things that was highlighted was the post-arrest care of the use of vasopressors and the titrating to a certain MAP. The kids that had a systolic blood pressure less than the fifth percentile for age did poorly, and that we should probably start throwing in some pressor support. Most of that seemed to be with invasive blood pressure monitors. master. So if you have an art line and a coding kid, then clearly it's a kid that I've screwed up already because somebody else put the art line in. Sure wasn't me. I'll ask a couple questions. The first is, do you think that there's a good time for invasive monitoring for kids in an emergency department setting? I did a fair amount of central lines and art lines in residency. I haven't done a whole lot since. Do you think that that adds a lot to our resuscitation in the ED compared to a non-invasive like a blood pressure cuff?
Yeah, I don't think it adds a lot. However, I'm mindful that opinion is also clouded by what I think about putting in art lines in small babies. It's hard. We've worked together in the ICU and the ED, but even in the ICU, the kid's already in there. They're tubed. They're set up. They're motionless. They're prepped. It's hard to put those little art lines in. So if that task takes you away from other critical tasks, I think it's a net negative. We kind of say, well, nobody died for lack of an art line, and that's true. Having said that, people have overcome these preconceived notions and done some amazing work. So a guy named Alfterheide in Wisconsin, they actually put art lines, admittedly in adult patients, but in the field, people that had cardiac arrest, out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, and they rolled out with the EMS crew and got an art line in and were able to monitor initial CPR in the field with an arterial catheter. Well, a lot of people said before that study, well, you can't put an art line in someone at the shopping mall or in the parking lot. Yeah, well, it was done, you know. So some of it, we have to be careful that if we say, well, it can't be done, and we're the people that decide if it can't be done, then it doesn't get done, you know. Having said that, if you wanted an art line, for a longer resuscitation, when it really generating those good coronary perfusion pressures can get more difficult because of modeling of the chest, you know, how hard you have to push changes as you do a longer resuscitation on someone. Perhaps if someone could get your best chance would be a femoral artery. Although, again, I know I sound like Mr. Research here. Bob Berg, back in probably the 90s, published with one of the ER residents, emergency medicine residents, a study that documented that the pulsations you feel during CPR in the femoral area are probably venous pulsations, not arterial. So, I don't know. It's really tough. You're doing CPR on somebody. They're probably somewhat hypoxic. They're not pulsatile. You may get blood in the catheter. I don't know if you're going to... It's hard to even know if it's an art line. So it's a super long response to say, I'm not sure if an art line helps you that much in the emergency department. But think about it in a long resuscitation.
So going from there, central lines versus peripheral lines, if we're going to start vasopressors, if we're going to start some kind of inotropic therapy, start peripheral or try for that central line? Because in the adults, we usually like to get that central line in quickly so we can start some pressors.
Right.
What about in kids?
Well, you know, your 15-year-old, 60-kilo young man, go for it. Get that central line. I think that sounds great. Your little chunky 10-kilo, early toddler, I think it's very hard to do. We wouldn't, in the ICU, if we had a patient have a sudden cardiac arrest, withhold starting pressors for lack of a central line. It's all a risk-benefit assessment. We know what happens when you extravasate these agents into the skin. It can be bad. We also know there's a risk-benefit to be sized up for central line placement, and it's even more unfavorable for the patient to put in a central line in emergency situations. More likely to miss, more likely to not be sterile as you would wish, etc. So for my money, and I think most of us in the ICU here, if you need it and you've got a peripheral, go ahead and use that peripheral for whatever pressor you need. And then hopefully you're going to get a good physiologic response and have a time to take pause and get a central line correctly.
And to kind of round out the last part of this, which pressor?
Yeah, so the paper that's referenced in the guidelines, I think Alexis Topchin is the lead author, but again, Bob Berg, he's kind of like Superman in this area, formerly here of the U of A, now at CHOP. This is the paper that talks about fifth percentile blood pressures and bad outcomes. That paper, to my knowledge, doesn't comment on a one presser preference over another. Just the notion that some kind of presser to augment blood pressure to avoid hypotension, it should probably be considered. There's certainly not a wealth of data to support it.
There's a new article I just saw in Pete's Critical Care that kind of compared epi and dopamine in septic shock, and it seemed like epi won out, which was interesting, because the thing I like about epi is if it extravasates, we do that all the time. We give it to people to take home and extravasate their epi into their EpiPen if they have anaphylaxis. So it makes me a little bit less concerned, and it's epi's a drug I like anyway, because we use epi for dying kids and for kids that just need a little help breathing. So it's something most of us are pretty comfortable with. It was an interesting paper that kind of probably still needs a little more look into it, but it kind of gave a little more push for me for epi, because especially for people that tend to see adults a lot more, dopamine has been out for years as causing more harm than good. And it would be nice to have something that's a little more similar.
What I would say is trying to decide pressors is such a complex research question, because it's a much different question if you're using a presser to support blood pressure in someone who has spontaneous circulation and septic shock, cold versus warm septic shock, versus the use of a presser in cardiac arrest. Even that is hugely fraught with difficulty. Witnessed, out of hospital, in hospital, how long is the downtime, what's the inciting cause of the arrest, so many things. A few years ago, a paper from Norway came out that Teresa Olast Vingen wrote. You can look that one up. I can't spell it. Norwegian. But it was really, really made a big splash, because it showed no benefit at all in adult out-of-hospital cardiac arrest using epinephrine. I think they even showed harm. Yeah. They did show harm. So anyway, there's that question. And then, what about vasopressin? How soon do you give it? When do you give it? What's the dose? How often do you repeat it? It's probably the most messy clinical research question you can imagine.
So if our septic patients aren't doing that well, they start to get towards arrest, they get into that that electrical phase, we're going to hopefully defibrillate them if they go into a shockable rhythm. And one of the new updates has to do with lidocaine versus amio if we can't defibrillate them well. So that was something actually done in our institution where we found that there was actually was it a greater mortality with amio, or was it just an improved survival with lido?
It was an equal, I think the final result, I should know, I was one of the authors. Santi Valdez, yeah, isn't that funny? I don't even really know what it says. Santi Valdez was the main author, and Rick Sampson, and Derek Hoyme, and myself. It didn't show a superiority of amiodarone over lidocaine. So it didn't show a lidocaine superiority over amio, said another way. That whole amio story with the Heart Association is a sordid tale. I think it happened in 2005, was the first adult recommendation. A class, I don't know if it was one or two, but a strong recommendation for amio. And there was a big cry in the community, like, wait a minute, what's going on here? We've used lidocaine for years. And hey, the drug company funded that amio study, and you guys are in bed with the drug company. And the Heart Association got burned badly. I can tell you the conflict of interest policy is so strict and well adhered to at Heart. There was no undue influence. It's not like someone on the committee said, hey, I bought a bunch of stock in Wyeth, let's recommend amio. That just truly does not happen. The reason that recommendation came down was the drug company had a fancy new drug called amio, and they spent the money to study it in a nicely prospective randomized way. And no one has ever, nor will they ever, study lidocaine the same way, because it's cheaper than Perrier, right? It's cheap. So so our study just looked at NRCPR database, the National CPR Registry database, and we tried to be good about it and throw out anyone who had previous antiarrhythmic use, anyone who could have had a confounding picture, and just said those that got lidocaine versus those that got amio. And we didn't show that amio was superior. So basically, on the strength of that paper, it got lidocaine back in with an equivalent recommendation to amio.
You can use one of the other.
Yeah.
Good. One of the other interesting things was we have not been using atropine in the ED for intubations for as long as I've been trained. But doing dual residencies, depending on which rotation I was on, I would use atropine before RSI or I wouldn't. And now it seems like like atropine is kind of out and out for being effective. It doesn't necessarily cause a mortality benefit. It doesn't help prevent any dysrhythmias. Do you think it's pretty much dead for RSI?
It probably is, but the things you think are dead, you know, still hang around. I mean, calcium in cardiac arrest has been really, should have been dead a long time, and still, you know, with the exception of hypocalcemia or hyperkalemia, still you'll find sometimes, hey, let's give him some calcium. It's like, you know, hey, that actually also sets off the apoptosis cascade. So, you know, you may not want to use calcium, right? Not to digress into calcium. I think atropine will probably follow a similar story. The literature doesn't support its routine use. I think the guidelines say something along those lines. There's a little fudge in the guidelines that says if you are going to intubate someone and plan on using succinylcholine for muscle relaxation, there you know, may be more support to use that to try to blunt a bradycardia response. We don't use it in our ICU here. We haven't. Another good thing was getting rid of the notion of this minimum dose. Like, you know, in babies there was a minimum dose, but if you're not going to use it anyway, who cares what the minimum dose is? I will say one situation where I use it is to see what I think about the peripheral IV. And I know that sounds weird, but you've got a little baby with a terrible little IV who you're going to have to intubate. And if you gave a little atropine ahead of time and saw a bradycardia, tachycardia, you know that IV's good. It sounds weird, but I was taught that, and I've used it a few times.
The only time that I've used it and actually seen and actually said, wow, I'm really glad I gave that, are the less than 1 month olds, the ones, you know, this is potentially going to be a tough tube, mostly because the physiologic aspects, I'm not going to have much time to get this tube.
Right.
One of our peds anesthesiologists, Wally, had told me, if you've got one of these kids, don't paralyze them. Just give them a little bit of Versed, get them a little drunk, and if you want to give them a dose of atropine to keep their heart rate up, I said, that's ridiculous. Until I had a kid with RSV that kept going apneic and gave him a little bit of, but we had time, got him pre-oxygenated, gave him a little atropine, gave him a little Versed, and I saw that kid's oxygen drop like a rock all the way down to 12. Heart rate never got below 160.
Oh, nice.
So we stopped, we re-oxygenated him, tried again, but it was nice not to have to deal with that bradycardia that makes the whole room just, you know, lose it.
So. Well, it changes it from, hey, we need to support this airway and ventilate, to we need to do chest compressions. You're absolutely right. The interesting thing about the atropine thing with the guidelines is, you know, we're saying, well, there's not really a role for it. Yet if you look in the current guidelines about the role for atropine in cardiac arrest, not for RSI, but in cardiac arrest, it's still indicated for places where the suspected inciting event was vagal stimulation. You know, that would be the role for atropine, right, as a vagalytic in cardiac arrest. Well, guess what? There's nothing like that cold laryngoscope in your throat to induce a vagal discharge. So I'm not sure the final chapter's been written on atropine yet. Who knows?
So to kind of round out, we get these patients resuscitated. We get them back from their arrest. The THAPCA trial, we talked with Khatri about that in May or June and just kind of discussed, you know, basically it showed fever is bad. And then normothermia versus hypothermia, kind of a toss-up. If I've got a kid that comes in cold and we get ROSC, should I keep them cold or should I warm them up?
Yeah, I don't think we know that, honestly. And THAPCA is probably one of the best designed and executed clinical trials in pediatrics. I mean, it's really well done and really answered a lot of questions. But there's still so many questions around hypothermia to be considered. So I don't know. If you've got someone that's cold, letting them stay cold, sure, maybe, as long as you know you're not having a bleeding problem because of the coagulopathy of being cold, as long as you're not having a cardiac output problem. So it's just so unclear. I'm not sure THAPCA answers it. The very interesting thing that that THAPCA does allow us to say is we don't and it's great, you know, we don't have to automatically be cooling these kids, because there are a lot of technical problems with that. I know there's an absolute difference. It was not statistically significant that a lot of people kind of looked at. I think it was 12 versus 20% survival in the normal thermia versus cooled. So maybe a better survival in the cooled, but the P was like 0.14 or something. So I tend to stand on those statistical good principles, which are, you know, it was designed well, the power analysis was done, the data did not show statistical significance. So those are equal therapies. I'm not cooling anybody right now.
So continuing on, I think one of the hardest parts about saying, okay, well, I do this often enough that I want to break away from the guidelines is when the rest of your team says, but this is what the guidelines say. One of the nurses, when I asked her about that, said, if I don't trust you as a doctor or if I don't like you as a doctor, I'm probably not going to veer off of the guidelines. So I think that's just the good team dynamics that you talked about already.
Yeah, I think there's plenty of opportunity actually as the team leader in a cardiac arrest to at least give a brief glimpse into what the thinking is behind what you're saying and the code that you're running. And so, you know, we tried to model some of that in the last PALS video of modeling good team behavior when you know the person running the code says, okay, this is PEA. You know, I think when the rhythm changes, you know, we go from saying, okay, that's an organized rhythm. Is there a pulse? No pulse. Then identify. This is PEA. We're going to do this. Compressions for 2 minutes. You know, and as much as you can do in a real code, say stuff like that. And let sort of give those that are working for you, if you're leading the code, a little glimpse into what you're thinking, and hopefully that, you know, you're thinking sound and you're on board with the right plan. It puts everyone at ease, and it will, I think, allow those people on the team that if you want to do something a little different, you can say, you know what, we're going to actually stop a little bit early, we're going to do this, and here's why. It only takes you 10 seconds to probably say that. I know it's a hard thing to ask in the middle of a stressful situation, but if you can do it, it's probably helpful for your team.
So the last question, because I know you got to go on to shift, and I appreciate you talking with us, is are you going to star in the next PALS video?
Oh, yeah. You noticed that I was making reference there to the video. I have gotten so much mileage out of that video. It's crazy. Dr. Mark Bradshaw. No, I am not going to. What's interesting is last time the Heart Association said, we're going to shoot the perfect video once and for all. We're going to use white backgrounds for the CPR, you know, video and everything, so we don't have to keep reinventing this wheel. Well, 5 years later, the powers that be, and I don't make these decisions at heart, is like, oh, we have to reshoot all this video. It looks so dated. It looks like an iPod commercial from 2010. It's like, yeah, that's what it was. It was 2010. And so, no, I won't be in the new video, but it remains to be seen who will lead the starring role. But it was a lot of fun.
That's good. Well, thanks again. I appreciate it. And thanks for all of your hard work of going through thousands and thousands of articles. To figure out how best we can do this. So thanks again,
Mark. Thanks, Aaron.
Do you know who I am?
No, I can't say that I do.
So who is Dr. Art Sanders? He's just an emergency doc here in Tucson. He likes to teach. Oh, and he's laid a lot of the groundwork in continuous chest compression CPR research. And he won a SEPS Outstanding Contribution and Research Award for that work. And he was the past president of SAM, and he was recently appointed to the Institute of Medicine. Yes, that Institute of Medicine.
I don't know how to put this, but I'm kind of a big deal.
Really?
People know me.
So, he is, but he would never tell you any of that stuff. Dr. Sanders prefers to teach one-on-one, and we're very fortunate to have him on the program this month to hear his opinion and experience with resuscitation research and guidelines. Take it away, Art.
He was like a god walking amongst mere mortals.
This is a kind of a follow-up to Peter Rosen's excellent commentary and review of the guidelines process in the American Heart Association and the process that built up really from the 60s, 70s, and 80s, along with the emergency medical services system. I wanted to just pick up from the 1990s and the 2000s. And what actually happened in the late 1990s was the evidence-based medicine train started rolling. and everyone was into evidence-based medicine and particularly randomized controlled trials. Along the same time, we were getting great studies on STEMIs, thrombolytics, emergent cath, PCI, and stent placements, and this was the gold standard that was used. And so in the 2000 consensus conference, there was a major effort to make the guidelines consistent with evidence-based medicine and to put randomized controlled trials on the top of the agenda. Now, nobody knew exactly what to do because there are very few randomized controlled trials and almost none that showed a positive response. But nevertheless, it was at the top of it, and a big effort was made to advertise it and to say that. On the other hand, as someone kind of involved in that time in trying to come with some guidelines, it was fundamentally consensus-based. Nobody really knew. There were really no studies to say, oh, how many times should you shock? Should you do it stacked or single or whatever? And there might be some evidence here and there, but it was fundamentally a group of maybe 10 or 12 people trying to do the right thing in terms of come up with guidelines, but not necessarily based on evidence-based medicine. So that's where I think the divergent came in. And then since then, there's been a train that rides every 5 years. So 2000, 2005, 2010, and this year, 2015. And it rides almost as soon as the guidelines are published. Then the training material goes out. And within a year or so, the next set of guidelines are prepped. And it's prepped primarily by asking questions about the old guidelines. And so the evidence-based answers to the questions depend on how you ask the specific questions. So, for example, the issue of is ventilation necessary for chest compressions in adults suffering a primary cardiac cause of arrest could be a reasonable question. But the question that is posed is there evidence that not doing ventilations in addition to chest compression is inferior to chest compression only? And so those are very different questions. And if the evidence isn't clear, you tend to do what's been done in other guidelines. And so that's what's been done, that grandfathering in certain ratios or what's been done or what was done in the last guidelines or what was done for the past 10 years has this level as if it were evidence-based and there were randomized controlled trials. But if you look back, there really weren't. And the ironic part, in 2005, when the guidelines were changed to 30-2 from 15-2 and 5-1, there was no evidence. There were no studies even 30-2. And that was completely consensus-based that we probably had to do more chest compressions and probably fewer ventilations because there were all sorts of concerns about ventilations really harming people. And so they sort of picked it, I don't know, completely out of the air, but sort of did some mathematical analysis and said, how can we get more chest compressions and fewer ventilations? But it could have been one ventilation. It could have been 50-1. So it's not so bad if you don't say everyone has to be doing it this way. 30-2 is the standard, and you should be doing it this way. If someone said, okay, this is one way of doing it, we'll teach it that way, but if other people want to do it another way and want to follow their data and see if they get better results, then that's a more realistic way to, I think, the way these guidelines and standards should be promulgated. So one of the issues is randomized controlled trials the best method of getting at answers to problems in cardiac arrest? And I'm really skeptical. If you look at the history, back in the 1980s, 1990s, Peter Saffer and his team at Pittsburgh led what was called the BRCT, brain resuscitation clinical trials, which were international trials involving thousands of patients, and none of it showed a significant difference. So they were all negative trials. This involved lidoflazine, it involved barbiturate coma, and they were looking for neurologic intact survival, and they didn't find it. And then in the 1990s, there was a movement of high-dose epinephrine, and again, it was a randomized controlled trial, didn't find a result. Well, after the 2000 conference, when again this movement is for evidence-based medicine, there was this, it was called the Pulse Initiative at the NIH, the Heart Association and Heart and Stroke in Canada and other organizations participated, and they said if only we had this a group of people kind of like the BRCT that would look at randomized control trials, that would organize, they would then find key factors that could really improve survival in cardiac arrest. And so that formed what was called Resuscitation Outcome Consortium, or ROC, which is a group of 10 cities in the United States and Canada, all of which had several EMS systems involved with it. And some were very established EMS systems, like Seattle, and others were sort of newer systems that maybe hadn't been doing research in the area. And one of the first things they found was that there's huge variations in their outcome from cardiac arrest. And then as they sorted it down, they would find, well, okay, maybe the variations are due to the way we train people and what we're actually doing. So, for example, there are a number of papers, very important papers that came out that looked at, for example, compression time, the time that you were doing chest compressions, and they found that the longer the chest compression, these were all database analysis, these were not randomized controlled trials, but they found that the higher the compression fraction, the better the outcome. And so they might look at a city like Dallas that maybe didn't have as good a compression fraction as Seattle. And they would say, well, Dallas, if you want to be in the ROC consortium, you have to train your medics to become better at this compression fracture to deliver more chest compressions. And the director of the person, a very good researcher, said, you know, he would go back and train the medics and give them feedback and do all sorts of retraining and feedback, basically CQI, continuous quality improvement, where he would continue to do that until their compression fraction went up. And this happened in a number of issues, you know, depth of compression and other sorts of things that we had the technology to measure at the time. And so these individual sites all built up what retrospectively seemed to be related to better outcome. So they all became fairly uniform in their system. And what the ROC group said was, well, it's only fair that if we're going to put out a randomized controlled trial, that all the baseline systems should have similar protocols and should have similar survival rates. Well, the problem is applying that result to another system who doesn't do this continuous quality improvement, who doesn't have whatever the resources, the knowledge, and other things in another area like San Francisco or Los Angeles, it may not be applicable. And so when the ROC studies were done, just like the BRCT before, they all had negative results. So, for example, I think in 2011, there were two New England Journal reports, one with something called the impedance threshold device and another another one with two mechanisms of delivering chest compressions before defibrillation, and they were both negative studies. And again, you have to look at, well, what happened? What were the studies? Where it was? And why are we getting all these negative studies? So one issue is this. Is this the right mechanism to advance the field of cardiac resuscitation? The other thing is to really learn of what actually came out of ROC. What actually came out of ROC is that if you apply intensive CQI, or some people call it learning health systems, where you give feedback, you constantly work to improve what we seem to think from retrospectively improve survival, will optimize survival and try to get all the systems consistent with the best systems in the country, like Seattle and Portland and those areas. Well, that's an almost more important message than the randomized controlled trials. The randomized controlled trials were negative, but we don't even know if that applies to other populations. But the CQI lesson is the one that needs to be, that we know that works if there are resources, if there's appropriate authority invested, and the appropriate feedback to get that level up. Let me change the subject and say, well, why do we have all these negative thousands of patients, negative randomized controlled trial? And I think for that, we need to think long term. And the big picture is really that cardiac arrest is not a uniform disease. It's the end product of multiple conditions, from sepsis to arrhythmia to drugs, etc. And the analogy that I've talked about is if we took cancer and said, oh yeah, a chemotherapy regimen with Gleevec or CHOP or something seems to be helping with some cancers. It helps in the laboratory. Let's treat everyone with cancer with Gleevec or CHOP therapy or something like that, or radiation in certain places or something like that. We'll almost certainly come out with negative studies. And so the next change in our approach is really saying, do we need these algorithmic guidelines where, okay, give this, and then 3 minutes later, give F, is try to individualize our approach to cardiac arrest patients. And we do this for everyone else. We see someone in shock, is it septic shock, is it cardiogenic shock, is it neurogenic shock, what's happening, are they in failure, etc. And we try to gather data. We treat the shock immediately, but we try to gather more and more data to help us be smarter about treating cardiac arrest patients. And so I think the next stage will come when we get away from this algorithmic approach. That may be good for people who aren't able to make judgments about it, and not only allow people to make judgments, but encourage people to make judgments. And we have some evidence, for example, end-tidal CO2 to guide cardiac resuscitation. I think there's a world of research that can be done with ultrasound and cardiac arrest, and there may be other technologies and other ways to do it, as well as clinical judgment. Does the patient have a fistula in their arm, or is there some history? Well, okay, bicarb doesn't usually help. It's not really part of the standard, but that patient, yeah, maybe they're hyperkalemia, you know, and give them a bunch of bicarb. And so by trying to sort out and make more individual judgments, I think we'd be treating patients much better. And I see almost the algorithms as a barrier that, oh, this isn't in the algorithm. Why are you doing this? Well, it's a young person. They're found in the street. I think it's a drug overdose. I'm going to treat them for that. And maybe it's wrong. Maybe they had an arrhythmia. Maybe they had a heart attack. But this is my judgment right now. Or it's an older person. Maybe they're septic. And, you know, this sort of stuff. I think we need to somehow change the structure that's out there, where we're, one, focusing on systems as well as hospital systems to really implement CQI and active CQI and allow systems to go out on the limb and take chances to do something different, as long as they're monitoring the data and educating people and adjusting it to develop the best outcomes. And then two, to try our best to individualize resuscitation just like we do for any other sick patient.